What's up, OUXers? Sophia here, and I am so happy to introduce you to Carolyn Sober-James, who leads the UX practice at Acumion. Acumion is a digital agency up in Madison, Wisconsin. Beautiful Madison, Wisconsin. Love that little town. And at Acumion, they have deep expertise in strategy and design and technology. And in this episode, we actually talk about how she uses OUX at Acumion to collaborate with her clients to save time on complex projects. She actually, in this episode, talks about how on this particular project that we dive into, they had a 7-week timeline. And she says point blank that without object-oriented UX, there's no way that they could have gotten it done in 7 weeks. So we really get into how OUX can be a serious time saver. So Carolyn, it's pronounced Carolyn, spelled Caroline. She's also a certified OUX strategist and a dedicated mentor within the OUX community, also a dear friend. She loves pragmatic UX, which is probably why she likes OUX. Radical candor. That's how she kind of, one of her leadership styles is with radical candor. If you haven't read the book, you should definitely check that out if you are in leadership. And Carolyn and I actually talked about radical candor in the last time I interviewed her when I was hosting the UX Hustle podcast. So you can go back to the UX Hustle podcast and check that episode out. We will link to that in the show notes. So this conversation is a real OUX love fest, but it is more than just us gushing. We do talk about how to run OUX workshops, how to bring your clients into the fold, and we get into some details on how OUX can help design better APIs. So lots of really hot takeaways in this one. And on that note of APIs, some quick updates from the OUX world. So Carolyn will actually be speaking at OUX Happy Hour on August 5th. So please join us there. You can meet Carolyn, hear all she has to say about OUX and APIs. So go to meetup.com/objectorientedux to sign up for that. It's, of course, completely free. And that is 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, dun, 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 in 2 weeks, sometime around the week of July 23rd, we are opening up enrollment for cohort 5 of the OUX certification program. So we are opening up only 38 spots, and those 38 people will be my world for 10 weeks. So last time around for cohort 4, the waitlist filled up the cohort in about a week, and we actually have about 3 times as many people on the waitlist this time as we did for cohort 4. So word is spreading, and if you know you want to be a part of this, please go ahead and invest in the self-paced masterclass. This is basically a priority waitlist, so meaning that you'll be the first to know when enrollment opens, and you'll get about a 48-hour head start on the wider waitlist. So if you just want to get on the normal waitlist, go to oux.com/waitlist. But if you want to really make sure you're going to be able to get a spot, go to oux.com/masterclass and go ahead and get enrolled. Get the content now. You'll get access to all the content. You go ahead and start poking around, and you'll get on that priority wait list. So you'll definitely be the first to know, and you'll be able to apply every dollar that you spend on that self-paced masterclass to the certification. So just think about it as a down payment where you can go ahead, you get access to all the materials, you can start playing around with it, and kind of get a head start on the certification, and just make sure that you can get a spot. If you have any questions about this, feel free to tweet me at SophiaVUX, or you can write me at hello@rewiredux.com. And again, all those links and email address, that will all be in the show notes. Okay. So let's go talk to Carolyn. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Carolyn Sober-James, welcome to the OUX podcast.
Hey, Sophia. It's good to be back.
Yeah, yes. Very exciting to have you back. So you were actually on a episode of the UX Hustle podcast, and then we republished you as a rerun on the OUX podcast because it was such an awesome episode. It's such a cool conversation. We were talking about OUX and game design. We're going to be talking about totally different things today. But for those that don't know you, can you just tell me a little bit about your role at Acumium as director of UX, and what does it mean to be leading the UX practice there?
Sure. So we're kind of a smaller agency. And so though my title is director of UX, actually my team is involved with, we're responsible for user experience, we're responsible for visual design, and we're responsible for digital marketing. So I'm actually thinking about maybe we should rebrand as like the experience team, because it's not just UX anymore. But basically my role is to I'm very, very client facing, working closely with pretty much all of our clients, very, very client forward, and then helping shepherd these projects through working with my team and the other teams, our development team, IT, whatever is necessary, kind of just moving projects through. And then also kind of figuring out how do we get ourselves into a sweet spot of how we do UX and new tools, new methodologies, new, whatever that can help us do our job better. And our shining star in our methodology toolkit is OOUX. So we've turned into an OOUX fan shop, I guess.
That's so amazing. So anyone out there that wants to have some UX work, they should contact you, right?
They totally should contact us.
Y'all are experts on it. And I have been using it for way before we even had the certification course. So I think the first workshop that I remember you being in was like 2016, I think 2017, something like that. So you've been using this for a while.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about just how OUX has evolved within your agency and what that looks like now?
Sure. So, we have been using it for a while. I think I might've shared this story the last time we talked on the pod about how we had gone to your one day workshop in Chicago, doing all the cool sticky notes on the high rise windows and all that. And literally the next day we had a discovery meeting with a client, and we hadn't intended on having it be an object mapping session, but that's what we did. And it was amazing. The client got it. We had a dev in the room, and afterwards he was like, "That was fantastic. I have a great handle already on what's going on here." So we started applying it right away, and we've kind of never stopped. So we, kind of by the virtue of some of the projects that we're doing, we don't always have the ability to do like the tip to tail methodology. But what we have really started leaning heavily on is the noun foraging, the object mapping, core object relationship diagramming, that kind of thing. And what's interesting is what we've discovered as we've continued to use it is that it's a fantastic tool for UX design, but it's actually turned into a kind of a mission critical tool for discovery and conversations with business stakeholders, and then the bridging conversations with our devs. So it's really turning into kind of a power tool, really centered on that object mapping piece. A power tool for sort of requirements discovery and just everybody getting a common handle on what it is we're trying to build. So that complexity deconstruction has been valuable all up and downstream in the project.
And that tip to tail process that you were talking about, that's the process that's the full ORCA process,
where full
we go
ORCA
through
process.
Four rounds of the objects, the relationships, the CTAs, and the attributes, which you were part of cohort one. It just jumped right on that, which is awesome. Our mm-hmm. beta cohort. And what I like to reiterate is it is a 15-step process, and then each step has multiple activities in it. It is mm-hmm. this sort of idealized process. Mm-hmm. And I always reiterate that it's a toolbox, right? And for every project, you're going to want to pull different parts. The object map is sort of that shining star that kind of pulls everything together, but different projects will require different concentrations. Like you know, one project, it might be like, okay, we've really got to hone in on prioritization because the client wants this, and we've got to really hone them in on what we can actually, you know, they want. They want the moon and the stars, and they want it in 7 weeks. We've got to parse it down. Or for something that's very complex, you might get more into that requirements and like really start thinking about like, okay, we got to really dig into the cardinality of each relationship. So that's just totally natural that you wouldn't, for every project, use every, and sometimes you would do them in different order too.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because I have people, I have sort of colleagues in the US UX space starting to come to me to just talk about OOUX. And one thing I say to them is that one thing I love of the many things I love about the methodology is that kind of no matter how much of it you do, it's going to be valuable. I've truly, there's no downside to it. Like any amount of energy we're able to put into following some of the OOUX methodology, it pays dividends. So it's a power tool for sure.
Yeah. It's scalable. I mean, you can do 3 hours of it and you have not wasted your time.
Exactly.
You don't have to do five, like the full, like, I mean, ideally it'd be like, oh my gosh, we would spend 4 weeks on this going through every round. And sometimes that's just impossible. And sometimes it's actually not needed too. Sometimes you can, you do just need to spend a few hours, like a half day. I mean, when I was working at the example that I give a lot is when I was working with Georgia Tech Research Institute. I mean, we had a half day workshop, and that half day workshop basically was laid the foundation of all of our information architecture, all of our navigation. And it was just figuring out what are the things that make up GTRI and really hearing it from the horse's mouth, hearing it directly from them. What is this institution? What makes it up? What are all the attributes, you know, what's the structure of those? How do they all relate to each other? What's the difference between a location and a lab? Okay. We really need to, let's talk about the difference between a location and a lab and how important it is for people visiting gtri.edu. I think it's gtri.edu or .org to understand that and to understand those relationships. I mean, 3.5 hours. And it laid the groundwork for everything we did afterward. So we wanted to talk about a recent project that you actually used OOUX on, and this is the Wisconsin School Music Association's Festival from 2020. So I've got some specific questions about the case study, but can you just first let everyone know what this project was all about and sort of the challenge that your team faced?
Yeah, so WSMA really, as many people did last year, had to pivot pretty hard on how they would usually do what they do. So WSMA, every year, they host solo and ensemble festival programs for students all across Wisconsin, every county in Wisconsin. I think they represent about 100,000 students a year.
Wow.
Each year. And so I don't know if you were ever in band as a high school kid, but I was. So I latched on really hard to this project because I actually did solo and ensemble. It was in Michigan, but I had immediate context for what it is they were trying to do. So obviously the in-person festivals were not feasible last year because of this tiny little pandemic that we had going on. So they were looking to pivot to a virtual festival. They were looking to see, can we take these activities that we would normally do on-prem via these 180 in-person events that they would hold every year and do them virtually. So, and they had a pretty tight timeline. I think we started talking with them beginning of August, something like that. And they really wanted this ready to go for the beginning of the school year. So we had a pretty tight timeline. And obviously this is not something that we have, a base app for or something that we can just kind of spin up and copy. This is a custom dev. So we took on the project and started with a discovery and road mapping phase, which is where OOUX featured very prominently, and kind of did a 2-week discovery and then dove into the design and planning and development and launch, and ended up being able to get this out for them in 7 weeks, which for a custom software app from end to end is a pretty tight turnaround. So we patted ourselves on the back a few times. It was definitely a success story.
That's amazing. And tell me a little bit about, so let's like just really dig into the details. So you already had some good context. Probably there was a little bit more just general domain research. How soon did you like tell me about that first OUX session, the first where you kind of got the clients in the room and started moving sticky notes around?
We had one of the things that contributed significantly to the success of this project is we had an extremely involved business, a set of business stakeholders. They were like with us 100% of the way, highly participatory, kind of shoulder to shoulder sort of thing. So they came into the initial discovery conversations having already thought through in pretty good detail kind of what they were looking for. So they had a lot of good stuff for us already to work from. And so we basically, spent some time reviewing what they had supplied.
And what was
And
that? Was that like
it was like
requirements,
a,
documents, vision
yeah,
decks, that kind of thing?
yeah, it was a requirements document that basically said, this is what we needed to do. This is how we do it now. And really it was just, how do we translate this in-person process to a digital process? So we really, I mean, if I recall, I think we had a project kickoff, and then I think our next meeting was an object mapping session. I think I had taken a first pass at stubbing out the object map in Trello just because digital, we weren't able to get together and do sticky notes. But I had taken a first pass using their document, my own context, and just the conversations that we'd had in kickoff, and then brought that to our first conversation, and the team just dove in, and we kind of kept working it through. And we might have had two or three meetings that centered around continuing to refine that. And then we moved into creating a backlog of functionality and prioritizing that and kind of figuring out what is our MLP, our minimum lovable product for
I
this app.
like that.
Yeah, I know it's kind of cute, but it's like, yeah, you can build anything that's viable, but we'd rather build something that's lovable, right? It's not ours. We heard it somewhere, but we've adopted it.
Yeah, it's great.
Really the anchoring deliverables from that first phase were the object map and this backlog, which we ended up doing in Airtable. It was all really lo-fi, very So we were moving fast and just working very closely together to get this done.
And so with that kind of timeline, I mean, I would say a lot of people would be like, wow, taking time for really getting that structure correct, getting that, figuring out that information architecture, doing that object mapping work. A lot of people would say, oh, how would you have time for that? We should immediately start getting into some wireframe. Let's start sketching screens because we gotta. What would you say to somebody that would look at that timeline and look at that kind of level of effort that you had to the lift of this? I mean, again, like you said, like you were having to, there was nothing you could really copy from. This is a complete custom build. If you had somebody on the team that was like, we just got to start sketching some screens, what would you say to that person?
Well, I would say that the only way that we could have met that deadline and had a good product is to take the time up front and do this, because this subject matter, this problem domain, was one that was sort of it was deceiving. There was complexity in there, that like really gnarly complexity around these event types and the music that was eligible for certain event types and classes within the event types. And there was all this kind of hidden complexity under the surface that if we had not taken the time to untangle that via the object mapping beforehand, we would have been sunk. Like we would have run into a buzzsaw, I think, of, oh shoot, we didn't realize this is how, yeah. So
You'd be redoing all of those
we'd be redo
wireframes.
and there's no way we would have met the deadline. So yeah.
So that when you were running those first sessions with the client, did they have any previous experience with this methodology? Had they ever seen an object map before?
Never, never. It was all new. I kind of did the 30,000 foot view of here's what an object map is, here's what all the pieces are. We've got the objects in each of these Trello lanes. We've got the core content, the metadata, the object relationships, the capabilities. And I kind of talked through what each of those pieces were. And they really took to it. And I think the fact that we were able to that first meeting, I was able to come with a start on the map. And then we were able to build from that was mm-hmm. helpful. They had sort of some context. They could start to latch onto it. It wasn't starting from a blank slate, which is not to say we couldn't have started from a blank slate, but I think having that little kickstart was helpful. But yeah, they really took to it, and they had very positive things to say about the experience afterward. I mean, I think it helped them sort of think more critically and in that complexity deconstructing way themselves, because like most business stakeholders, they sort of take for granted these things. They sort of get it at their own abstract level because they work with it all the time. But taking the time to sort of unwind it and think about all the pieces and parts, I think there were a few eureka moments for them too, in how they think about this stuff. So, and it was interesting because they had had a legacy way of doing this for these in-person festivals. And so they were thinking about these things in a certain way, just by virtue of repetition and having done it one way. And us coming in as objective third party and doing this process, we raised some questions that I don't think they had thought of, which could help sort of tune and refine how they were thinking about this problem domain themselves. So it was great.
What were some of those, can you remember, like what were some of those questions that they hadn't thought about or any of those eureka moments?
Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. It's been a little while now. I don't know if I can pull back a specific example, but it was just, you know, kind of asking some questions about some of this complexity underneath with these event types and the classes and the music that's associated. And then there was even further complexity with the music. Just by virtue of us not being as close to the subject material, we were able to ask them some interesting questions that had them sort of thinking through detail that they maybe hadn't thought through before.
And that's what I mean, I always say this process, like complexity can't hide from this process. You're just shining a floodlight on all the dark and dirty corners that will eventually, you'll have to handle eventually.
Yeah.
It's just a way to kind of get it so everyone's looking at it. Everyone can see those tangles, and together as a team, you can untangle them without thinking about the UI on the screen, which right. you're, stakeholders are, that's not necessarily what they're good at, is deciding like what UI is best, or mm-hmm. looking at a UI and kind of mentally reverse engineering it to say, will this UI meet our requirements?
And I was just gonna say, when we did get to the point of doing screens, and that was the other thing with this project, I ultimately developed far fewer wireframes than I might have normally. And mm-hmm. then our lead front end dev and I worked very closely on moving this stuff into a coded prototype as quickly as possible. So what was interesting though was that as soon as we got into some screens and showed the WSMA team, they were like, "Yep, that looks like what we mapped." So they were able to hearken back to the object map and the UI already made sense to them just by virtue of having done that upfront work. And then the front end dev and I, as we were working through it, he was able to take because he was involved in all of the object mapping sessions as well, which was also critical to have him sitting in there and participating and asking questions and all that. So he was able to take that object map in concert with the reduced set of wireframes that I did put together and make smart decisions on extending some of those patterns through the rest of the system. So it was, that also contributed to the efficiency of the process and our ability to meet this really tight deadline.
Yeah. 7 weeks. So let's talk about that 7 weeks. All right. So the first 2 weeks you're doing discovery and then maybe doing some wireframes, and then you're starting.
And then we're going. Yeah.
You're going into building. Were you able to do any research? Did you have any time for research? Was it really just working with your subject matter experts in that object-oriented way and doing the noun foraging? Did you get to do any primary research, talk to like some of those user roles, like teachers and students?
Yeah, we didn't really. This was a case where we really had to lean pretty heavily on the domain knowledge of our mm-hmm. business stakeholders. But the primary users, the roles in the system were going to be the teachers and the adjudicators, the judges that were evaluating these performances. And, you know, I don't know if the WSMA team may have reached out to people, but I know one of our stakeholders had been in the adjudicator role herself.
Great.
And so she was able to bring some of that personal experience. And she worked very closely with adjudicators. So, you know, ideally, yeah, we would have been able to talk to some teachers. Students actually are not currently interacting directly with the system.
Okay.
It's really, so teachers are sort of the proxy for their students. The teachers submit the registrations and kind of shepherd those through. And then the adjudicators come in and do the evaluations, and then the teachers relay the results to their students. So I think eventually the idea is that students might be directly logging in, especially once we get to an in-person kind of thing, which is coming. They've reached out and want to talk about phase two of the app. So
that's really exciting to start of see what that's going to look like, blending an in-person event with that virtual event, which I think you mentioned in the and that we just saw so much last year as these virtual events became so much more accessible to people, and mm-hmm. you could involve a lot more people. So now we're going into the world of the hybrid events, which are going to mm-hmm. become more and more of a thing, and that's mm-hmm. going to be a challenge in of itself. So let's kind of like talk through the O, the R, and the C, and the A. So can you just name off like what were the main objects within the system?
Sure. So we had an object inheritance right off the bat, because we had a person who was using the system, and then we had a person who was an adjudicator and a person who was a teacher. Then we had, we did represent students in the mm-hmm. system, because obviously the students are the ones who are doing the performances. We had representation for school, because there were, I can't remember how many schools we ended up having in the system, but it's a lot of schools. And then students and teachers would be associated with schools. We had the registrations themselves, so the, you know, signing up to do this. We had music, we had, you know, all of these, musical pieces, compositions that could get associated with, an event. We even had stuff like rubrics. So when an adjudicator went in to evaluate a performance, they would use a scoring rubric to, as they're watching this video of this student doing their flute solo or whatever, they would be evaluating the performance against these scoring rubrics. And so we had to have this notion of rubric in the system as well.
And were there different rubrics?
There were.
Okay.
There were, I want to say there were like 21 different rubrics that would be applied to different events of different types for different reasons. So there's
21 basically. So then that gets into kind of our tree system, where you probably have the rubric template and then the actual rubric filled out by an adjudicator for a specific piece.
Right. Which became part of the part of the evaluation. The most complex part of this whole map was around this notion of event type. So a registration would be for an event type, and an event type might be a flute solo, a clarinet solo, a brass trio, a violin quartet, you know, whatever. But then there were, within an event type, there were, there's these this notion of classes. So class A, class B, class C, which is sort of the, you know, like in school sports and stuff, there's
right. Varsity versus university.
Yeah. So there was all this, you know, bridging stuff going on, where we, that's really where a lot of the complexity came in. And then I think I'd referred to that sometimes the music that was eligible depended on the event type in the class. There was just a lot of dependencies in this little nugget around the event type. So just saying, hey, I'm going to register for this event, there was a lot going on there saying that we needed to accommodate.
So registering for the event, you'd have to say, okay, what class event,
yep.
and then yep. what piece is going to be done.
Yep.
And which yep. students are going to do it. And that yep. all kind of comes into the registration.
Yep.
How did you document all of those dependencies and all of those basically business rules? Was that in Trello or did you use another tool to document that?
Just by virtue of having to move fast, mostly it was documented in Trello and then just by very close conversations with the WSMA team. So there were definitely some clarifying conversations like, okay, explain this to us again, how this works. Cause they knew this Pat from their previous experience. And they showed us one of the tools we used or one of the resources we used in doing this project was they had a spreadsheet that probably thousands of rows, like of all the event types, all the pieces of music, all the classes. I mean, they kind of had it all in this mega mama jamma spreadsheet. And so that was a resource. So I think that the object map and just lots of conversations with the team. So
that spreadsheet was kind of like a content inventory. I mean, it gave you an idea of what were all of like actual instances of the, and so I'm sure that was like something you could really sink your teeth into to start reverse engineering that to figure out what the actual objects were going to be, not to put words in your mouth, but how did you, when you got that spreadsheet, what was your process on sort of using that spreadsheet?
Yeah. So I think the spreadsheet, if I recall, I didn't really dive into the spreadsheet until after a couple of the deeper conversations with the team. So the spreadsheet then really became a way to fill in gaps or say, hey, I noticed this. How does this work? Or how do we reflect this in the system? But for the most part, we were able to get the foundation pretty spot on just with those initial conversations and object mapping sessions.
Wow.
But yeah, it was quite the spreadsheet. It was.
yeah. But I'm sure that was like an amazing resource to have to be able to understand the real content, to see some of those. So there's real instances.
Yeah.
And what are all the different columns? Because those columns are probably going to help you figure out some attributes.
Yep.
Very cool. So was there anything interesting about relationships, any relationships that really were sticky and needed to be ironed out as a team that, you know, were kind of confusing for people?
Probably mostly around that event type and class, that little nugget, that was where it got the most complex. There are going to be some interesting, they had mentioned that eventually they want to, maybe talk about accompanists on these events, and teachers can be accompanists and fellow students can be accompanists. So there's going to be some interesting stuff to kind of work out there. I think other adjudicators maybe can even be accompanists. But really, I don't recall there being a lot of, beyond that sort of event, piece. Most of it was pretty straightforward.
So what about figuring out the interactions? So those CTAs, those calls to action, those capabilities, when you the roles we have teacher and we have adjudicator, right? So those are your main roles. Did you go through, what was your process like to figure out, okay, what does a teacher do? What is it like, just a teacher, can a teacher create a student, or are the students pulled in through an API? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So we just kind of talked through that with the team. For this initial phase in particular, the division of responsibilities between teachers and adjudicators was pretty clean. Uh-huh. So teachers were responsible for inputting their students. We didn't do any sort of anything fancier than that. Teachers would put their students in. Teachers would create the registrations. They would submit them for evaluation, at which point they would become available to adjudicators. And I guess one piece of complexity was that not all adjudicators can judge all kinds of events. So the adjudicators that could potentially evaluate a performance were limited to those who were eligible, I guess, to judge that particular event type. So an adjudicator who was, you know, only eligible to judge clarinet solos, for example, would not see a flute solo waiting for evaluation. But once the performances were ready to evaluate, then they were kind of ready. They were there in like a pick list, basically, for eligible adjudicators who could then, you know, pick them off and evaluate them. And once the evaluation was done, then the teacher was notified that the evaluation was ready. And it all seemed to work pretty well. Actually, it was really cool because we launched this on Wednesday, November 4th, 2020. We had our first registration submitted by a teacher the following day, and it was a clarinet solo. And we had the first evaluation completed a day after that. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we went from launching the app to having a completed evaluation in 2 days. And wow. Yeah, and so, you know, I had asked the WSMA team, I said, you know, I'm really curious to hear what your teachers and adjudicators think about the app. So if you hear any comments, I'd love it if you passed them along. And one of them they passed along, it was from a teacher. And this teacher said, you know, I don't know who all was responsible for putting this together, but kudos to the team. This was really seamless. And I'm like, that's a love language right there for yes. a UXer, where you have a user say something was seamless. That's like, you know, starshine and rainbows popping out of the walls. So,
hey, y'all, quick interruption. Just wondering, does Carolyn have you convinced yet that OAUX is a super, super valuable tool to bring to your clients, to bring to your projects? So just another quick nudge, go get on that wait list for the OAUX certification course at OAUX.com/waitlist, or even better, go ahead and grab that self-paced masterclass to go ahead and get access to all 22 hours of the course content right now and get on that priority wait list for cohort 5. To do that, go to OAUX.com/masterclass. Okay, back to the show.
And congratulations, but I'm not surprised.
Right.
Because yeah. if you think, I mean, and even though because of this crazy timeline, you weren't able to go and, you know, do the ethnographic research and go and talk to users, which is, you know, we always recommend that, but often we can't do it. But if we're going through and we really are figuring out what the things are, just the truth of the system, like mm-hmm. these are the things in the system, this is how it's worked for decades, probably. Mm-hmm. And these are how people want to interact with these things. Here's how they all relate to each other. There's not going to be a whole lot of surprises. It's just going to be, oh, okay. The teacher goes in and they say, okay, all right, got to add my students. I got to, you know, say which class it's going to be. This is class B. Here's my students. They're going to be doing the clarinet solo, mm-hmm. or the one student would be doing the clarinet solo.
Right.
It makes sense that it would make sense in the end, yeah. But that's just so amazing to hear. So let's talk a little bit more about prioritization, because mm-hmm. I'm sure that there were ideas that came up mm-hmm. and you had that backlog in Airtable. Mm-hmm. So often when we build something fast, it turns into throwaway work, especially from a dev perspective. Mm-hmm. From a user experience, because we haven't structured the thing very well. We've just kind of like gotten something out there and then we're like, okay, now that we have time, we're probably going to have to scrap a lot of that and rebuild mm-hmm. stuff. Do you feel like you've created a foundation that you can build on, or are you going to have to kind of back up and untangle some things for phase two for this year?
Yeah, I think it's 100% a foundation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I haven't heard that there's been any big oopsies like, oh, we really missed this workflow or there's a big gap here. I think, you know, we have a very strong foundation. And from the prioritization standpoint, again, huge credit to the WSMA team. They were really good at making very critical decisions. They understood what was really critical and what could come later. And I think, you know, some of the things they probably would have liked to have had in the initial go, but they got it. They knew that they might need to make some difficult decisions to move ahead. But I think what we have out there is absolutely solid. And the great thing is that because of the approach we took, because of taking an OOUX approach and doing the object mapping and all that, we've started the system of Legos where we can, you know, when it comes to adding new, you know, in-person festivals or whatever, it's not going to be like, you know, moving mountains to get those added in, because we were thinking about those already when we set up the initial structure. So it you know, the scalability is there, and the idea that they might come to us with additional requests like, hey, can we do this? Hey, can we do this? Not scary at all. We have a very strong foundation.
I mean, it's exciting, you know. Oh, it really? We get to add in an accompanist. Like, that's a fun challenge instead of like, oh, that means we're going to have to tear so much apart to add that in.
Right.
That's the beauty of this approach, is rolling in a new object, or whether the accompanist turns out to be a new object, or if it turns out to be upgrading the teacher and the adjudicator object, or adding some sort of new permissions or something like that, you're working in this object-oriented way. So you're sort of saying, okay, well, we've encapsulated these things. Now we need to upgrade them so that they can do more and be more, but it doesn't necessarily mean that like we need to pull the whole thing is going to unravel.
Right. Right. Yep.
Very, very exciting. So let's talk, let's just shift gears a little bit near is there anything else you want to say about the case study, about what you did for this organization?
No, only that I wish I got to do projects like that all the time, you know, maybe with a little bit more generous timeline, but combining the really interesting and meaty subject matter, which was meatier than it might seem on the surface. You know, once we got in, it was really like, there's a lot here. And untangling complexities absolutely become one of my favorite things. So it's like, yes, please more of that. So combining that really interesting subject matter with a highly engaged stakeholder team, which is a privilege that, you know, you don't always get. So definitely appreciate the WSMA team being so involved, and the shoulder to shoulder work with us was critical. And then just the opportunities that are now in front of us to help them extend this, and coming from a really strong foundation. So I loved this project. It was a blast. I mean, it was an enjoyable project to work on, and the team was great, and we had a good result, and the, you know, lots of cool stuff on the horizon. And, you know, I just say, I'd love to do three of these a quarter, you know, like.
That's everything you can ask for, right? From a project. It's fun. Your clients are great. And you have, there's more work on the horizon to continue to do some of the stuff that didn't make it in, and to start tackling that backlog, but in a way that doesn't feel scary or like your heart sinks, like, oh, we have all this technical debt, we have all this UX debt.
Right.
We can just start building upon this. We can just start upgrading our object, maybe making a few new connections that we didn't make, maybe give this one a little bit more metadata that we didn't have before. Yeah. Very cool. So one last question about this project that I actually, almost breezed over, because I get, even for folks that have gone through the certification process and have learned this, like, you know, really, really in-depth, had this in-depth training, sometimes are fearful or hesitant to start actually running the workshops, bringing in the business stakeholders, whether it's clients or, you know, their PM, the developers, and doing that facilitation. I love that you just ran with it. It was like you did the workshop, and the next day you're like, let's give this a try.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to folks that want to start doing this, but are still feeling like, are people going to get it? I'm not sure if I can explain it. It's going to feel new and different to a lot of people, especially those that have done UX discovery in a very different way. Mm-hmm. How would you encourage those folks?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, I guess if somebody's in like an agency sort of situation, I would say look for something internal that you can do this, because we've used this for internal stuff on several occasions, and it's been really useful. So if that feels less risky and it might be an easier way to kind of dip a toe in and just get if it's the issue of like being comfortable doing the facilitation, do it with an internal team that's safe, you know, just mm-hmm. say, this is an experiment. I appreciate you going along with me. Let's try to map this thing out. The other approach might be if it's an issue of getting people to buy in or feeling like it's going to be too much for people to tackle, just to start a workshop from scratch, would be if you feel like you can take a first pass at mm-hmm. defining some objects and maybe fleshing out a bit of the map. My experience has been I think 100% that when I come to conversations with something already started, that jump starts the conversation and people can kind of latch on. You know, after I do a really quick intro of the pieces and parts of an object map, and then just you start asking questions. You know, is this correct? What's missing here? You know, what else belongs in this object? Kind of thing. I've not found that it's really. Maybe I've just had really, really uniquely suited clients to this process, but they latch on pretty quick and they participate and they don't feel intimidated because it's not technical. It's just talking about the things that they deal with all the time.
Right. It's not technical. And I've had the same experience too. And I think that some of it, and this is probably, I'll take some responsibility for this because the course is so in depth. I think that folks feel that maybe if somebody hasn't taken the 22-hour course, it doesn't understand everything about it, they're not going to be able to participate. But that intro that you do, I mean, what is that? 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Like,
right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, hopefully that's encouraging to people.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think from that one day or that we did with you in Chicago, you had one of the handouts was the key to the sticky note colors. And I still will pull that out. I'll still have copies of that for people. And I say, here's a little cheat sheet for you, but we're going to kind of walk through this. And
man, I need to update that key.
I probably have a retro version of it.
You do have a retro version, but you have the most current version too, which is unfortunate. So mm-hmm. I'm writing that down now. Update that key. It should be downloadable on OAUX.com, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Get with the program, Sophia. Yeah. That's very interesting to know that you're still using it. You just lit a fire under my butt. Okay. So let's talk briefly before we wrap up about APIs
and OAUX.
Yay.
Acronym, all the things.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Acronyms on acronyms. So APIs. Application protocol interface. That's right. Right.
Oh gosh.
It's protocol, right?
We should know this. Application programming interface.
I always say protocol. because of HTTP is protocol, right? Okay. Yeah. Application programming interface. My bad.
But everybody calls them APIs. So
yes. Yeah. API. Yeah. So you just had a talk proposal accepted to that conference. You're going back to that conference. You've spoken with them before. And your talk is going to be it's going to be one of those in-person and virtual events, right?
Yeah.
So that's July 27th.
July 27th. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Up at the Kalahari in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So the Kalahari sounds like a beautiful place.
I think it's a resort. Yeah. Okay. I've actually not been there myself. I don't think
so. I mean, it sounds like a great conference. So for any of you that want to actually go to an in-person conference, the floodgates are open. That's going to be, I think, July 27th, 28th or 26th, 27th, somewhere around there. We'll put a link in the show notes, of course, to that. And your talk is titled When OUX Meets API Design, Love at First Sight, S-I-T-E, cute. Can you tell us a little bit about this talk and why you thought it was important to talk about OUX in the context of APIs?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, this kind of came up by virtue of my being a mentor for the last cohort of the OAUX certification. And I think you had asked the question about how we might kind of tap into how OAUX and APIs can kind of talk to each other. And I went out and I started, you know, because I think as I maybe shared in our previous pod episode, before being a UXer, I was a backend dev. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I could take a shot at this, sort of this I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm going to make the commitment and figure out how to do it later. So I started looking at API design, sort of principles of good API design, and there's huge parallels with what we try to do with OOUX. You know, kind of making things very usable. In this case, it's usability for a developer, not an end user. Clear documentation, self-descriptive documentation. There's a bunch of other stuff, but as I was looking at sort of principles of good API design, it was like there's a lot that's complementary with what we're trying to do with OOUX. And obviously, because when we're doing OOUX and we're going through the ORCA process, one of the things that we're doing, you know, like with the capabilities, I think, as you said, it's you're putting a pin in for where interaction might go. Mm-hmm. And so that directly feeds into development decisions. And the whole structure of an object map can directly feed strongly into a data model, usually does. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely opportunity, I think. And here's where I've started exploring this a little bit, but I think there's more we can do here where the object map can become a tool for developers as well, communication with developers. And so, you know, if you're talking about developers figuring out what are the things I need to accommodate in this API, the object map can be a guide for that. Like, you know, for WSMA with the schools, get all the schools or get a school with a certain ID, you know. And so I'm even thinking that there's opportunity, and I think I'm going to try to explore this in my talk, of how you can put some suggestion or tag pieces of the object map and note that there could be an API connection. Mm-hmm. Like this might be a place to create an API call to get all of these things, or update all of these things, or delete this thing or whatever. And had a little bit of experience kind of adjacent with APIs and object map. We've been doing some work for a staffing agency, and they have a backend system. We've been building an interface for them to use with their clients, and they have a backend system that they use as kind of their system of record that has an API that we've had to use as a data source for this app that we're working on for them. And so in the course of, we did some object mapping with them for this app that we're building. And in the course of doing that, I found myself kind of plugging in places where I think we need to get this from the API, or yeah. I think, you know, so I think there's opportunity to expand on that. And I haven't exactly figured out what that is, but it could be that, and I probably will need to collaborate with a dev or two to figure out what might make sense here to, not that we want to do the API design in the object map, but at least planning for mm-hmm. the API design, I think could be a really strong way to create that transition between the early object mapping work and the downstream stuff.
I mean, it's like, well, one thing we do is when we look at our attributes, we do think about what is the source of this attribute going to be. So mm-hmm. is it a person putting it in? If it's a person, which person is putting this in? And then, or is it coming from an existing content management system? So is it coming from within the organization, or is this particular attribute or this entire object actually coming from outside of the organization?
Right.
Do we need to pull it in somehow? Are we going to be pulling that in manually? Are we going to be, you know, pulling a spreadsheet from something and then uploading it, or are we going to actually live connect this? Mm-hmm. So with some sort of API so that when updates are happening, that data is staying in sync. Yeah. And I just think the organizations that are going to be successful are the ones that are thinking about how to play nice with other organizations. So not mm-hmm. only how are we going to not create our own? So Imogen Levy talked about this on her podcast with Moorfields. I think that was just the last podcast that was released. And so as a hospital network, you have to make the call on like, okay, do we create this content? Should we be creating this content as an iHospital, or should we be taking this from the larger NHS network? Mm-hmm. And then they're going up to the larger NHS network and they're oh, there's not an API for that. We can't, or we can pull it, but the data is going to be such a mess when we pull it in. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be useful for us. So figuring out not only what is the source of each of these attributes, but which attributes are we creating that can be a source to our partners, to other organizations. And if we structure that data nicely, you know, we can kind of, we don't need to repeat all of this content over and over again and end up with, like in Imogen's case, 30 different definitions for cataracts. And the definition of cataracts on the NHS site is different than the definition for cataracts over on the Moorfield site. Mm-hmm. And then you end up with these situations that are bad for the user and also a maintenance
nightmare.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there's absolutely, you know, you've got API considerations that are incoming from external systems. And then you've got, if you want to take this thing that you're building and create an API for others. So it's the outbound and the inbound. And I think figuring out how we can start to kind of put those pins in at the at the early stages of OOUX will do nothing but help help the downstream work.
I've run into just from using Zapier quite a bit, Zapier or Zapier, however you want to say it, and trying to integrate, for example, integrate Meetup with OOUX.com. So we have the meetups, the OOUX happy hour show up on OOUX.com, and I'm not doing a bunch of copying and pasting. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when I change update the description over here, I would rather not go and update the description somewhere else. And Zapier can kind of do it, but because the API is not great for Meetup, it's just like the information that they decide to give me is either garbled, or so I have to like do some math or like some other kind of scripting to get the data to sort of do what I want it to do. Or just like I feel like the fields that have been provided are really arbitrary. They're like not the fields. They're like all like the backend ID fields.
Right.
But like the description, I can't get the description. I don't remember if it's the description, but it's something like that. It's like the date. Like I can't get the date, but I can get like the key string from the back end that no user would ever care to see.
Right.
So I feel like if there was more planning and thinking about what might be used, what might be used from other organizations would be really amazing.
Right, right. That and even down to like naming conventions, you know, because sometimes I think if you leave a developer to his or her druthers on what they name something, it may or may not be the clearest name or most accurate name for a field that's delivered in an API. So kind of going back to how the OOUX work helps us define glossaries and common nomenclature and all that, that if we can start to define a shared naming system at the outset, maybe that's even something that we start to pin into the cards in the object map. Mm-hmm. Like here's a suggested field name and do it in camel case or whatever, you know, the devs like, but here's sort of a suggested name so that when they get into actually doing the work, they're not having to make decisions. They've got something that they can work from. And if there's a reason to do a different name, then fine. But at least there's a start that can kind of make make their job easier and make the end result better.
Totally. I've definitely through Zapier had to like revert the name is just not what I think it's going to be. And I only can understand it because Zapier does do a good job of pulling an example instance.
Right.
So then I'll see a value and I'm like, oh, like if I didn't have that value as an example, I would have no idea what this is. And that's not to take stuff away from the developer. It's so that the developer can focus on what they're good at and not necessarily just kind of thinking up, oh, what should we label all of these things? That should be more of a user experience decision. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. All right. So last question for you. So I, of course, feel like OUX, and I think we're on the same wavelength as sort of the big missing piece and the overall mainstream UX practice. Is there anything else that's missing? What else do you think that our industry should be doing more of or focusing on more of to kind of continue to mature?
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know if it, I don't know if it's something that I think maybe it's something that our industry should do less of. One of the things that I personally get really kind of, I don't have a lot of patience for is that some of these terms and processes that some UXers get really precious about and kind of to the detriment of the overall process, I think. And so my thing, you know, I think of the work I do is it's a service role. And the point is to be of service. The point is not to protect the definition of this thing or that thing, or, you know, kind of come down on people when they say, like one of them that I understand where it comes from, but I don't understand the furor over saying UX, UI design. It's like, yes, I know those are different things, but, mm-hmm. but they're both kind of going to a similar end. You're trying to make the digital world suck a little bit less every day. Right. So I think that kind of just recognizing that the ultimate thing is to be of service and to do the right thing and maybe be a little bit less precious about some of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I see a lot of that too, that kind of that vehement kind of crusading.
Right.
And at the detriment to sometimes what your actual role is,
right?
Which at the end of the day, you have a client or you work for a company. And another one that I see that Jonah Tolley and I have been talking about quite a bit is this, like, I'm fighting for the end user. I'm protecting the end user. And we have to do that.
Right.
But we have to be thinking about the business too.
Absolutely.
We have to be thinking about our client needs, never to the detriment of the user. We never want to use like dark patterns or anything terrible like that. And we want to make sure that the user is happy because that's going to be best for the business.
Right.
But we really, I think we need to be better at balancing those and to sometimes not get so to that tunnel vision that we can kind of get.
Yeah. And the goal is not, the goal isn't perfection. The goal is to be better. The goal is to make something that's better. Peter Shankman, I don't know if you're familiar with him. I saw a talk with him. I could think it was like shortly before pandemic. But he said, kind of talking about brand differentiation and all that you don't need to be perfect. You just need to be 1% better than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that will, and that kind of stuck with me. It's like, so make those compromises and yes, 100%. The end users are absolutely critical, but the business is critical too. And, there is a place for balance and, you know, yes, there are things that you probably will need to go to the mats for and say, I'm not okay introducing a dark pattern. And here's why it's ultimately not going to be good. And you try your best to advocate for doing the right thing. A lot of times you'll win those battles. Sometimes you won't. And you just kind of have to sleep easy knowing you tried to do the right thing. But yeah, there's absolutely a balance. And I certainly appreciate the people who are all gung-ho for, 100% end user. Like, I get it. I think that's great. But in the world we're in, there's shades of gray and if you can play within those shades of gray and make good compromises and fight the right battles, then the end result is still really good. Usually.
Right. We can't be too precious and with our processes too. And that includes OUX, like we were saying earlier, you know, sometimes you're going to have to, like, if you do 2 hours of it, amazing. Sometimes you're not going to be able to fully sell it on a project. And sometimes you're going to be, you know, doing a little Saturday afternoon object mapping to bring it in on Monday. And you're just doing it in the back, you know, in the back room. And it's not going to be this like beautiful, perfect 15 step workup process. You'll just take bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are going to link to all the things, your upcoming talk. Congratulations on that. And all the Twitters and the LinkedIns. Anything else you want to leave all the OUXers out there with?
Oh, gosh. No, just we're doing good work and keep spreading the OUX gospel. It's really funny. I'm starting to get more and more people being like, now tell me about this. What is this? And latching on. So I think we're gaining some steam here. So
the snowball is growing a little bit.
Snowball is growing. Yeah. For good reason. It's good stuff.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Carolyn.
Thanks, Sophia.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!